The Kickoff with Steve Hothersall.
Rock, sport and talk.
Radio City Talk.
Callan Irwin in for Steve Hothersall as he continues his lengthy summer break. He will return at some point. I think it's the day after bank holiday. He's finally back. Don't know what his tan will be like, but probably not as good as mine, Gav.
No, Al, I don't think anybody... I don't think it was at George Hamilton the Fourth used to have the mad tan years ago.
Yeah.
You're not as bad as yours, Al. Yeah, yeah.
That's the voice of Gavin Buckland, Everton's official stat man, the statistician who's in not just to talk about the Blues, but we will touch on current Everton as well. But this excellent new book that you've written, Gav, Money Can't Buy Me Love.
Money Can't Buy Us Love.
Buy Us. How does it say?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the
that
Beatles.
Was the
song,
Beatles.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. It's a book about Everton. I think it's long overdue, really. Really about Everton under John Moores and Harry Kattrick, going from when Moores joined the club in '60 to becoming director and then chairman, and then Harry joining in '61, and takes the story right through to Harry departing in '73.
Yeah,
a period obviously a great success.
Yeah,
in the
indeed.
60s.
Yeah,
great success for the city. In the 60s, yeah. Both on and off the pitch. It was obviously
both
a centre
winning
of
leagues and cups. And,
yeah, centre of culture. And probably the most relevant bit today is that it was Everton with the Mersey Millionaires, because we were bankrolled by Littlewoods, who were, as I say in the book, who were 500 times bigger than Everton when Moore took over. Their turnover was 90 to 100 million pounds.
Well, how Evans, times change.
Yeah, Evans was 200,000. Which is about...
Paying players that now, a week.
A week, yeah. So that just shows you. I mean, I suppose it'd be like Everton being taken over by one of the tech giants now, wouldn't it? Something
if you're talking Facebook
about
takes
it. Yeah, the size of Everton to Littlewoods at the time. So we were known as the Mersey Millionaires. And as I say in the book, they were very much... Moores was very... much a sort of unique character then, I think, in English football history, in as much as that, though they'd been demanding chairman before and so on, clubs had had money before, Moores was obviously richer than virtually anybody had ever taken over a football club. And also he was far more vocal than any other chairman before in terms of demanding success.
Yeah, because at that time you didn't really know football chairman and directors of the club at all, did you?
Absolutely not. And managers tend to have a job for life. You know, you could finish mid-table every year and you kept your job.
And games without a win now and you've had it.
Well, exactly. And a lot of that originates, I think, from that thing that Everton started in the early 60s. I mean, at his press conference, obviously there's the for unveiling Harry Kattrick as manager in April 61. There's the famous story of Kattrick's predecessor, Johnny Carey, being sacked by Moores in a taxi, hadn't he, which was very famous. And Carey had finished fourth. And somebody asked Moores in the press conference, Johnny Carey's finished fourth and he's gone. What happened to Harry Kattrick? And said, what happens if Harry Kattrick finishes fourth and Moores in? I said, he'll have to go as well, won't he? So, and that was very unusual.
Taxi waiting for him.
Yeah. So that demand for success from the top and that ambition from the top hadn't really been there in English football. And now it's there at all levels in the Football League, isn't it? Not just the Premier League, but, you know,
so was that
divisions.
A good thing back then as far as Everton were concerned?
Oh,
that
absolutely.
Drive and ambition and determination to be the best?
Absolutely. You know, Nilsson's Nisi Ottoman, wasn't it? You know, ultimately, though, I think, and I touch on this in the book, it bred a bit of fear in the club. People were uncertain about the jobs. You know, if you're players, you know, where they're going, your chairman's got an open checkbook. You're sort of a bit scared whether that demand for success.
Really replaced, you mean? And,
And that demand for success obviously placed enormous pressure on people. Placed enormous pressure on Harry Kattrick, because obviously he had health problems by the time of the early 70s. So it was a great thing for Everton, but it also bred a bit of unpopularity. I say in the book that it was a bit like when Abramovich came into Chelsea in 2003. Yeah. And Ranieri was replaced by Jose Mourinho. There was a bit of that in terms of Johnny Carey, who was a gentleman manager like Ranieri, being replaced by somebody with more ambition and sort of the chairman sort of thought was a kindred spirit in Harry Kattrick. And unlike Chelsea, you know, what it was like with Chelsea in the early years of the Abramovich era, not the most popular club in England,
not at all,
with all due respect.
No.
And Everton was the same, you know, and I touch on...
Was that a touch of jealousy? And
absolutely. I think also as well, there was that sort of irony that obviously the Littlewoods fortune that was used to fund Everton was based on the pools. Well, who plays the pools? Football supporters.
Yeah.
So supporters, you know, the irony of money derived from supporters of other clubs via the pools. It was then channeled
and
into...
And the pools were so big then, weren't they?
It was then channeled into buying players for Everton. So there was lots of things going on. And it was just that that drive for success and ambition and ruthlessness that sort of sent shockwaves through English football, which at the time, in the late 50s, early 60s, was very much a grey, austere area, you know. And
Everton ahead of the times.
They were. I mean, I've said since, I mean, in many respects, the first modern football club. That's what they didn't really... Obviously, would never have realised at the time, but they've created the template for the way all clubs operate now in terms of like that ambition from the owner.
Right.
That ambition from the manager. But if the manager doesn't deliver in a short space of time, you can be sacked.
Yeah.
And where success is everything. And, you know, and they didn't realise it, as I say, but Catrick and Moore's probably invented that modern... Yeah, on football club, so another first for Everton now. You know, but,
well, a football club of firsts, aren't they, in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And the book then goes on to tell the tale of the success in the 60s. There was some darker moments. There was obviously the infamous People newspaper revelations in 64 around alleged match fixing and alleged pill taking amongst the players, which are covered in a lot of detail. And then we get into 66, winning the cup. And then we get into that glorious period after Alan Ball came of the Holy Trinity and building up to the title in 70. But within that sort of set decade of the 60s, there was a lot of dark moments, a lot of grey areas, which I've covered. I wanted to write the book as a...
What gave you the inspiration?
It hadn't been done before.
Right.
Yeah, there's one of them. Everton... I was talking about this on Saturday, that for a club that prides itself on, if you know your history, it must be the most unrecorded,
really
unreported club of any of the big clubs.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Rob Sawyer, who I know very well, he did a great biography of Harry Catrick, but that's Catrick's whole life and career. And obviously the 60s only passed that, but this period has never really been covered. And that was the inspiration for it. And it was such a great decade of change, and I've touched on this in the book. Not only for Everton, but obviously Liverpool's rise under Bill Shankly made it a really fantastic time on Merseyside. Yeah. And also culturally and economically, you know, you had the Merseybeat era, the rise of Liverpool as a cultural centre within England and indeed the world. You had, you know, Liverpool was economically, you know, as affluent as what it's been since, you know, the glory days of the docks
still,
in the 19th
still
century.
Still reliant on the port, even at that stage.
Yeah, right, absolutely. And then I cover that thing, how then the city declined and then Everton declined with it after 70. I wrote 8,000 words on the sale of Alan Ball, and a lot of stuff in there has not really been out there before, you know. So I've been quite determined to sort of challenge narratives, because that's what happens over the years, doesn't it? You know, narratives arise over football clubs. So, Shankly and Catrick were very different. And actually, they weren't. It was just that certain things, they were different, but there's lots of things they had in common. And I've been keen to pull that out. And, you know, because people say, oh, Shankly welcomed, you know, the media and all that. Well, that wasn't really the case, certainly at the start. I mean, some of the media couldn't understand what he was saying.
Well, no, but occasionally he gave good sound bites.
And
didn't he
did. Well, that's what the media liked them. Your media coverage in the 60s started to grow on the back of the World Cup victory and all that. So it needed, as I say in the book, it needed people to like sort of sell the product. They needed people to hang on to.
At that stage, we're a lot closer to the managers and players of the clubs than they ever get nowadays.
And so the press sort of needed Shankly more than he needed them. It was only after a while that Bill grew into that sort of media colossus, I suppose you would say. But even that's a little bit overstated, because there wasn't that much telly about football then and lots of things. So,
I don't know, the first match of the day was only 1964.
So there was there wasn't wall-to-wall coverage like it is now. So
only live game was the FA Cup final, wasn't
it? And England-Scotland and the European Cup final. And it was, but ultimately, that sort of like dampened Everton in terms of their reputation as well, because like it or... Loads that they did sort of become a reputation of a club that was anti-Everton. Having created a modern football club, they were very, they didn't really like television or the amount of money that people would pay for television. You know them Sunday afternoon games you used to see on Granada and stuff like that? in you know how much you got they paid the clubs in
probably
in the 70s?
Peanuts.
£30. Yeah.
It's just unthinkable, isn't it?
30 quid. If you're on Match of the Day, I think you got £750.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about it now, whether it's millions a game.
Incredible, you know, the commercial opportunities that present themselves now. I mean, there were times when, Liverpool, I think, were the last club to actually have advertising on the shirts. They declined that for years and years.
You couldn't have advertising on telly.
Yeah.
I mean, you had the clubs had to take the shirts off, didn't you? You know, with the advertising on.
Covered up, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I remember when Everton played the Crystal Palace, I think in 81, Jim McDonough, who was the Everton keeper, he came out for the second half accidentally with a sponsored shirt, and the TV cameras didn't show him during the entire second half.
How would that work in the goalmouth scramble?
But ultimately, all that commercialism and that sort of rise of agents and big transfer fees, that all started in the 60s.
Yeah.
And the media coverage, as I say, across telly and radio and newspapers, that also became massive after England's World Cup win. And that was the era when players became stars in themselves. And I covered all that in the book. And Everton had a great star, obviously, saying Alan Ball.
Yeah.
And we won the title in 70. And then I covered the decline after 70, which was quite pronounced. Ironically, in the backdrop of Liverpool's rise again under Shankly and in the early 70s, so it was a fantastic period.
You do an awful lot on Alan Ball as well. Was that around the was it acrimonious, the departure?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. I think there was I detail about 7 or 8 incidents that not necessarily been out there before involving Alan Ball and Harry Catterick. It all started in a heated discussion between the two after the game against Sheffield United at Goodison in September 71, because Alan had been given the captaincy after he won the title in 17, and he was, what Alan was like, he was very vocal, he demanded a lot of people on the pitch, and I think that rubbed up a lot of the players the wrong way.
The rest living up to his standards he wanted, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah, but there's ways and means, and Alan could be like that, be quite vocal on the pitch and be quite dismissive of the players. And there was one or two, arguments. Him and Howard had a big fight at Chelsea. The referee had to separate them, and I think that unsettled the club, I think, after 17. I think that was part, one of the reasons why Harry was quite happy to offload them.
Right.
Plus Alan's form in itself had died a little bit after the World Cup in 70. And I'd say that was enormous. Alan was the most famous player we had at the club.
Mm.
In fact, I'd say he was probably the only player we had who was known in every household in the land, you know, and I think the sale of Alan Ball was quite symbolic in terms of having been the Mersey millionaires at the start of the 60s. Mm. We were now selling our best player and best well known player in a decade later.
Mm.
And I'd argue the case that, in some respects, that in the book, that it's not been the same since that we were actually closing a golden era for the club in 71. And then, Harry had his health problems. And by the time Morse actually come back as chairman in 72, it was too late. And then you had Liverpool's, obviously, Kevin Keegan had come in 71. Liverpool were then, by 73, Everton looking for a manager while Liverpool were becoming champions. And we're like in the early 60s, Liverpool in the second division when Morse had come to Goodison. So,
Bill Shankly had to get him out of the second division, didn't he?
Yeah, so? I mean, that was the other thing. I swear, is Littlewood's, it couldn't happen now. Littlewood's influence across both clubs is enormous.
Mm.
You know, they own sort of 30% of both clubs.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I mean, how does that work in terms of, when they play each other? You've got people who've got a vested interest in both parties, and the league rules allowed it. I'm not sure whether they allowed the days of dual ownership and stuff like this. There was a lot of people. It was about 30 people who had a lot of money wrapped up in both clubs. I mean, ironically, Morse was chairman Everton while being a shareholder of Liverpool.
Yeah, wow.
Which is just funny. But where it was relevant, and it's still relevant today, is what Morse knew. And he was head of the game, John Morse, is the city had to have two good clubs. He always felt that he wanted them to be like Real Madrid and Barcelona. The importance of having two big clubs who were driving against each other and raising the game and competing against each other.
But in the same city, that's almost unheard of, isn't it?
It's good for the city. Mm-hmm. And certainly, it was certainly good for the city in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
Certainly good for the city in the mid-80s. Yeah. And I suppose the modern parallel would be, say, Man City, Man United, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some respects. And he did acknowledge that, and I still think that's true. In the city of Liverpool needs two successful football clubs. Mm. I think Liverpool may have changed a little bit over the years, but that helps if your rivals are sort of improving and a threat.
Yeah.
You've got to raise your game.
Well, certainly drove each other on, didn't they?
Both the 60s and 80s, definitely.
Yeah, just thinking, going back to your, you know, writing the book, and it's starting in the early 60s, as you say. But you know, you're only a nipper at that time, aren't you? So, what's your first memory of actually getting along to Goodison Park or being an Everton fan?
That when we won the title in 70.
Right.
Yeah, I remember my dad coming home and saying he'd won it, though I'd not be in the game, you know. And I remember going on holiday to Ponsons and Ainsdale in the summer of
70. That long trek.
in my Everton kit. And I had a pair of Alan Ball but white boots, you know.
Yeah.
And playing with the kids who must have been in the same set of chalets or something.
Yeah.
And like being like, we are the champions, you know. And I thought it was a year after that I went to my first game. But the good thing about researching it is though I thought I knew a lot, you don't really until you properly go into it. And I did a lot of research, obviously, through the local press, millions of books, a lot of research in Manchester Library. You've got a load of the old regional newspapers and a lot of research in the British Library in London. Mm. We've got a load of the national newspapers and loads of archive material, and also the David France Everton collection was a great.
So there's an awful lot of work goes into it before you even put pen to paper.
If it counts at the hours up, it's probably a full time job for years.
Yeah.
But it's great to do, and you do learn a lot about the city as well as Everton and about Liverpool as well. Mm. But it was it's just a fascinating period of the city and of British life as well, and I think that was reflected in the cover of Everton at Wembley in 66 in front of the iconic Radio Times advert, you know, on the stands.
So you were always blue, your family were
I think
of that persuasion. And
I was quite fortunate that a friend of my father's knew Howard and Joe Rowe very well, and they came to the house on a couple of occasions when I was a kid, you know. You know, I think Howard give me half.
That's quite something, isn't
it? Yeah, I think Howard give me half a crown for naming the other team, which is, given Harry Catterick's secrecy over team selection, was probably probably the highlight of my academic life. You know, so it wasn't the periods where it was going a game, and obviously it was before I was born. You know, half of it, but it was. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can't do anything about it. You know, it was just a fascinating period of time. You know.
And then from obviously winning the title that 69-70 season, you become a regular at the games.
Yeah, 72. Yeah, I started February 7th against Walsall, just when we were going into decline. You know, and I was talking about this the other week. My first game was the first Saturday in February 72, when. My first game was more people watched football on Merseyside on that day than any other day in history.
Right.
Because those are the days when both teams used to kick off at 3 o'clock in the FA Cup on the same day.
Yeah.
So Liverpool played Leeds in the FA Cup, which was that was the big
Leeds
game in England,
flying,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's that myth, isn't it, that Liverpool and Man United is the biggest fixture in English football. I think it has been for a few... 30 years.
Yeah, that rivalry's grown, hasn't it?
Yeah, but for 10 years, the biggest fixture was Liverpool against Leeds.
Yeah.
And so 56,000 on Anfield, 45,000 at Goodison to see Everton play Walsall. And the same day, Tranmere had their record attendance at Prenton Park, 25,000 against Stoke.
Wow.
Yeah, so across the three grounds, 126,000 people on the same day.
And I was at Tranmere Stoke that day.
Were you?
Yeah. That was one of the first games my dad took me to see,
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah.
2-2. And Stoke were a good team then, wasn't it?
Yeah, just about remember that. And then the first Everton game was Everton-Arsenal, and Everton lost 2-0 at home
to
Arsenal.
Yeah.
I think he took me in the top balcony, which seemed miles away from the pitch when you were a little boy.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think that's great, that, Al. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, because it was 2-0, wasn't it? And I talk about that in the book, about our decline after 70.
Yeah.
In that, that all them big clubs in the 60s with the legendary managers, you know, your Man United's, your Leeds, Tottenham's, Everton's, all went in decline after those managers left. If you think about it, United got relegated. Spurs got relegated.
73, was it, United got
relegated. Spurs got relegated. Leeds eventually went down. Yeah. Chelsea got relegated.
Yeah.
All went down. Arsenal didn't get relegated with the bottom of the league at one stage in the mid-70s.
Yeah, the only side who haven't been relegated.
Yeah.
The top flight.
And I say that in the book, that one of the reasons for Liverpool's success initially in the 70s was like all the big city rivals from the traditional rivals from the 70s had all disappeared. Yeah. You know, and although Everton fans don't like the talk of the 70s because they think they were rubbish, compared to a lot of other big clubs who actually had a decent effort.
They weren't playing in Division 2 as well.
Exactly. And it was only, and that last, that bit, you know, if you think about the teams who were really good in the 70s, it was like the likes of Stoke, Burnley, QPR.
Yeah,
Southampton.
Incredible, isn't it?
Nottingham Forest. Yeah,
Queen's Park Rangers were pushing. They've finished runners up on
to the pool in 76. Yeah, yeah.
Derby County.
Yeah,
yeah.
Under Brian Clough, obviously. Yeah. And you're seeing that change then in the '70s after the '60s, which had all been the big industrial clubs from the big, you know, the big rich clubs.
Yeah.
And it took really the start of the Premier League to redress.
Wow.
Redress that balance. If you think about in the '80s, who were the clubs on the up in the '80s? Oxford, Wimbledon, Luton Town. They were all teams regularly finishing the top six.
Incredible. Well, even Carlisle were in Division One in 1970 and topped the table after three matches in 1974, I think.
So. Infamously cost Evan the title because we
lost. Did he lose home and away?
Home and away.
Carlisle.
They won both three. If they got 3 points from four, they would have been champions.
Yeah. Quite incredible.
But that decline had set in then for lots of reasons. Harry, I think, probably felt that. Was given a 9-year contract in 1969.
Wow.
Now, if you're a manager on a 9-year contract, what's your motivation? You just won the title.
Alan Pardew got 7 years at Newcastle.
And people...
He's still getting paid, I think.
Yeah. But people laughed at the Pardew thing. Well, give him 9 years, you know. And I think the similarities between Everton in 70 and then Liverpool in 90 and stuff, when you really need to, your success has been earned, so you need to change a little bit to stay at the top of the game, and you lose your manager and stuff and don't really replace him adequately, you know. And I think there's lots of similarities, and the game was changing. The transfer, people weren't paying big money for transfer fees. If you think about Liverpool when they won the title in 73, oh, look at where Kevin Keegan from. Ray Clements, Scunthorpe.
Yeah.
Alec Lindsay came from Bury.
Peanuts,
Larry Lloyd came from
Clements.
Larry Lloyd came from Bristol Rovers, didn't he?
Yeah.
Steve Harvey came from Skelmersdale United.
Yeah.
You know, you had players.
John Toshack.
Yeah, it was Cardiff, though. He was quite big money, wasn't he? In the early 70s, the transfer thing had changed, where the clubs who were successful then, because there was no money and people wouldn't release their biggest players, the clubs who were successful bought players down the lower divisions and developed them or rebuilt the careers of people who'd lost their way along the way. Like Brian Clough was great at that, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And Everton didn't adapt to that changing world, and that was one of the reasons why they started to decline after 70, you know?
The Kickoff with Steve Hothersall.
Rock, sport and talk.
Radio City Talk.
We've got Gavin Buckland in the studio with us talking about his excellent new book, Money Can't Buy Us Love, which is a love of his, of course, Everton Football Club. And the book obviously takes you through the Mersey millionaire stages and culminates, I suppose, in what you call the declining years.
Absolutely, after 70, the decline was quite sharp, and in many respects, when the team's struggling, it's easy to write about.
there's more to tell than
if they're successful, what can you say? You know, play great football, that's it. Like, you know, but when a team's struggling, it's actually far more to get into.
You don't want to be Man City nowadays, do you?
No, absolutely. and I think after we won the title in 70, Ball, Harvey Kendall, you know, yeah. etc. And then obviously the four players, the World Cup. And they said that some of the decline initially was down to, you know, the effects of the Mexico and playing at high altitude. I mean, I dispute that to a degree, but, you know, that's what some people have said. And then they went into 70-71, favourites for the title, European Cup.
Yeah.
I mean, I cover in the book, terrible record in Europe, Evan, you know, in the 60s.
They played Panathinaikos in that.
Yeah, yeah. So they played Inter, you know, typical Everton.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Yeah, preliminary round of the European Cup. The competition proper hadn't even started. I knew they'd be drawing into Milan. Just one Serie A. You know, shades of Villarreal, you know, they went on to win the European Cup for the next 2 years.
Yes.
Typical, you know, the year before, if she'd have got Floriana of Malta and won like 15-0 on aggregate, Everton get into Milan, you know.
Yeah, big name at the time and still.
71, we go into, you know, Harry crucially never bought anybody. So in 70, should have bought players, you know,
right,
to keep things fresh.
Yeah,
didn't buy anyone. And that was a crucial thing. And there was some players who were really nearing the end of their career. You know, Brian LeBone was had been playing for 13 years. You know, like Sir Johnny Morrissey being playing for Liverpool.
LeBone had gone the World Cup though, hadn't he?
He played in the World Cup. They'd finished.
Mexico, yeah.
And had he just thought, oh, it's been successful so far, we'll just carry on being successful, you know, we've got players coming through the youth ranks, all this. But he never really strengthened the squad, considering that they had that pressure of three.
So was that not that competition for places, you mean?
No, or? in the 70s there was, in 60, you know, just like what the Liverpool used to wear, 14 players,
something like that.
Yeah. It was completely different, but there was still scope, I think, for them to buy at least two players. And he bought Henry Newton, from Nottingham Forest as a midfielder, but then said no, you've got Paul Harvey Kendall, so by Henry Newton in the midfield, I'll be able to play him. And there's that muddled thinking at the time, you know, with Harry, and he tried to sign Archie Gemmell from Preston. A memorable story about it, which I tell in the book, about Brian Clough got wind that Harry was trying to sign Archie Gemmell, turned up at Archie Gemmell's house and stayed the night until he signed in the spare room. The best thing about it,
I'm not leaving until he's...
And during the evening, this is a Sunday night, during the evening, the Gemmells didn't have a phone, and Harry had the next door neighbour's phone, who turned out to be Ken Knighton. Remember, he became a manager later on, Ken Knighton?
Sunderland, I think.
And he was in Madison Street. He was Artie Gemmell's next door neighbour, and he had the phone, and Harry had the number. So Harry phoned Ken Knight, could speak to Artie.
Right.
And his wife went next door. Brian Clough sitting in the living room, and Artie Gemmell's wife goes, it's your mum on the phone. Because that was the code. And never happened. And
incredible.
Because he was supposed to go to Everton, and who was Artie Gemmell's manager? Alan Ball's dad.
Right. Alan Ball Senior.
Yeah. And I say in the book that he had a... Was it in Alan Ball Senior's best interest to sell Artie Gemmell to Everton when could be a threat to his son?
No.
And Artie went on to be a great player, didn't he? And I think I think some of the bad blood with Alan perhaps started around that time. And so 70-71, poor in the league, gets a march though, picked up a bit, European Cup. As you say, Panathinaikos, who were the lowest ranked of the eight teams left. Ferenc Puskas was the manager. A player who John Moores twice tried to sign at Everton.
Wow.
Yeah, in 60 and I think in the mid-60s. Both Home Office rules
wouldn't allow. A little different then, wasn't it? Yeah. Bringing foreign players in.
Yeah, weren't allowed. You know, you had to be resident in the country for 2 years before you could sign. And Moores wants them to be a director of Littlewoods and all this as a way of... all very modern
getting
stuff.
Around
that,
it, yeah.
This is all very
forward
modern
thinking.
Stuff that happens, you know, at the time, to give them a little bit more money, you know. And we played Panathinaikos European Cup, and we had the FA Cup game at Old Trafford against Liverpool, and we blew the Panathinaikos tie, 1-1, Goodison.
Yeah.
Battered them. They scored and we scored in the last minute, and going to Greece then was a real awkward place to go to.
We finished 0-0.
0-0, yeah.
Away goals, yeah. Was done for on away goals.
Yeah, against a team they should have really beaten out of sight, and that was on the Wednesday. And then Harry had taken ill on the Wednesday night coming back from Greece, and then he didn't go to the semi-final at Old Trafford. He was too ill.
Right.
And he played Liverpool, of course, and you know, we all know what happens. Everton winning in what we say a similar theme since Everton win one at half time in an FA Cup semi final against Liverpool and end up getting beat.
Was it Alan Evans and 2-1?
It was Alan Evans and Brian Hall.
Brian Hall, yeah.
Yeah, and Brian LeBone had gone off injured, you see.
Yeah.
And I think it sort of unsettled the defence. And they allows, you know, big touch out the field there, you know. And we got beaten. We went out to two competitions in space of 4 days, and that wasn't the reason we declined, but it was just a symptom of Harry. We were missing players at Old Trafford, and if Harry had strengthened the squad, we would have had a bit more to choose from. And the players were getting old, as I say. Labby was in his 30s. Johnny Morrissey had been playing for 13 years. You had players who've been around a long time, you know. And Liverpool has regrouped, obviously, after the Watford defeat.
Yes.
In 70.
Yeah,
so
Shankly started
all that
to churn the team, didn't he?
All that team that won the title in 73, they all started playing, you know. And Tommy Smith had a great game and never really recovered from that. Though that wasn't the reason the team went into decline, as I say, it was the symptom of it. And it just tailed off from there. I mean, Michael Charles had said beforehand, you know, before those games, it's the most crucial week in history of Everton Football Club, you know, and they went out of both, and it was never the same then. And the following season, this was my first season, we were just awful, you know. Lowest goal total set. We scored 37 goals in 42 games, 9 goals draws, but still, Everton being Everton, still managed to rack up the biggest top flight win of the 70s, beat Southampton 8-0 at Goodison, with Alan Ball's last goal, and that was in November 71.
Right.
And then Alan's form had dipped. There'd been a few incidents with Harry. And then the weekend before Christmas 71, they got beat at Derby, where a few things had happened. And Bertie Mee, who was the Arsenal manager at the time, who was a big fan of Alan Ball, but also a big fan of Colin Harvey, who was also up for sale at the time.
Didn't want them both, did he?
I think he may have phoned up about Colin Harvey and Harry offered him Alan Ball, you know. And then, as we know, Ball went to Arsenal. That was the right decision, I would say.
Mm.
You know, I don't think Harry, you know, and he made the wrong decision. He was doubling his money. But the problem is he then had his heart attack 2 weeks later. Two things, as I say, probably interlinked. Mm. And he never bought the right players then.
Mm.
You know, that window there to buy players after them sold Ball had gone. And by 72, though they started the season well, 72-73, they went into decline. And, you know, by the April, Harry had gone after a really poor run where they got beat at home in the FA Cup to Millwall, which is a really bad defeat, you know, probably the lowest point. And the poor players in there were nowhere near. Nowhere near as good, you know, as what they'd had. You know, some of the players they brought in are just infamous amongst you know, Rod Belfort, you know, Bernie Wright.
Yeah, Bernie Wright.
Yeah, John, you know, whose memorable, you know, departure from the club. And had a few share, but too many at Belfield is recalled in some detail.
Yeah.
John McLaughlin. These were players who had never got near the B team in the 60s, you know, but Harry was paying big money for them and you know, two or three years later, and
so these were tough times for Everton, really.
They were, And once, you know, we've seen it many times. Once a club starts going into decline, it becomes very, very difficult to rein it in. And with Harry's bad health, it became an impossible job. So by April 73, ironically, sort of to the day in which he joined 12 years before, the club sort of, you know, thanked him for the services, but then didn't have a new manager, of course. So he effectively then stayed in charge, haven't sacked him. He then stayed in charge for the rest of the season. It was
strange.
They then got into this the infamous thing where they chased John Revy around Greece to be the next.
Trying to get his services.
To get John. He was the big manager, best manager in England at the time, at Leeds.
Yeah.
Whether that was the popular, the popular, like, sort of selection amongst Everton fans. I'm not so sure because you know Leeds had a reputation at the time.
Dirty Leeds.
And of course, I remember like somebody saying to this time, Everton spelled backwards was not Revy as well, even better.
Wow.
There was a great story, isn't there, about Revy going to see Moores, and Moores had a big house in Freshfield.
Right.
And Revy had a mustard-coloured Mercedes, and he couldn't find Moores' house, and he stopped a member of the public. And the member of the public said, no sat nav stand, but what I did is phoned the Echo.
Right.
Just to tell you, there's a bloke who looks like Don Revy's looking for John Moores' house and phone. That source of intelligence is just, it'd be on social media now. Imagine that now.
No.
I just see Don Revy,
you'd have a picture with him now.
selfie, but that's the way it was then. That's one of the great things. The book is how the media changed the way it reported on football, and from it was all very staid and sort of, hoity-toity, shall we say, in the late 50s.
Yeah.
But we got that rise of tabloid journalism then, during the 1960s, looking for exposés and all this. Everton the victim of it, as I say, with the people who have gone a couple of times. And as well as the Tony Kaye thing, which obviously hadn't happened at Everton, but...
Well, that made front pages, didn't it?
Yeah, Tony Kaye's banning from the game in 64, though... What had happened happened at Sheffield Wednesday was also a big impact on the club. And I think we didn't have that great reputation within the press because we were very uncooperative. I put this out in the book. Moores actually got two academics from Liverpool University to do a study of Everton's media relations.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Interviewed the press, interviewed people in the club, all that type of stuff.
He was ahead of his time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. About what can we do to redress our... bad reputation, it wasn't great, and some of that still sticks, I don't think you lose that.
No,
I think some of what people say is attitudes of towards Everton and Liverpool now within the media, I think it all goes back that 50 years, I think Liverpool's reputation now still goes back to the
of course
the cop. It was Match of the Day,
Shankly days.
Alec Weeks, who was the producer of Match of the Day, loved the cop because if the football was rubbish, he just put the cameras at the terraces.
That was the first one they filmed. Match of the Day. Gav being absolutely excellent, got a cool time on it. Money Can't Buy Us Love, the story of Everton from the early 60s through to 73. Go and get a copy if you can. There's a lot of hard work gone into it, I know that by the sounds of it. So hugely enjoyable read if you're looking for a gift for one of your Everton family or friends, then that's the book to buy. Money Can't Buy Us Love, Everton's official statistician. Gav Buckland, been a great chat, and we didn't even get a chance to touch on Everton of today.
That's probably not a bad thing, someone would say.
The Kickoff with Steve Hothersall.
Rock, sport and talk for Liverpool.
This is Radio City Talk.